I've been advised that we received some motions this morning in this case. I have not had a chance to look at them yet. I doubt if my colleagues have either, since they just got here this morning. Is Mr. Jones present? Mr. Jones, you're moving to continue the case this morning, is that correct? Come on forward, please, sir. Thank you, Mr. Smith. We'll get back to you. This is the last sitting of this term, and this motion came in just this morning. It would be delayed until next year and probably assigned to some different panel if we were to grant a continuance.
Next year being September, October.
Next term beginning in September. You are moving on grounds of surprise and prejudice. It says, I've not seen this motion before. Apparently, it was just filed this morning. Is that correct? What's the surprise? Step forward to the microphone, please, sir.
Basically, I've been experiencing should I state my name?
State your name, that'll be fine.
My name's Kevin Michael Jones. I'm the appellant in this case. And I've been experiencing substantial difficulty from compelled discriminations and segregations from a void judgment, which was the first judgment that was entered in the case on December 8th. And basically, when Nickus Curia wanted to have the case unsealed, it seems like through the relitigation of those factors, it's really compelled or compiled upon me or been complicated. And the reality of I was preparing a motion for extension of time, and then and I was going to refer to it as a second motion for summary judgment, as I did some research on summary judgment, and I wanted to find.
We don't have summary judgments in the Court of Appeals.
I understand.
There are summary affirmances. Sometimes summary reversals, but that's rare. I'm not hearing anything that sounds like surprise, Mr. Jones.
Well, the surprise
situation is what it's been all the time.
No, sir. Well, the surprise is that on March the 31st, and I didn't get depleted fully in my motion for a continuance, is where I had all my belongings, all my papers, all my records, and it's not the first time that it happened, but I didn't have any idea. On March 31st, I found out that all my paperwork and things
were going to take your motion under advisement. We will go ahead and hear argument from the amicus curiae and the government this morning.
Can I ask you one question?
We don't usually answer questions. We usually ask them, but I'll let you ask and we'll see if it's something we can answer.
In essence, I was trying to prepare a certificate last night, and my computer started acting up, and I couldn't get the mouse to keep still. And I wanted to write a certificate because I wanted to amend a pleading under 15B, Civil Procedure 15B, so I can give the court the actual details where previously I pleaded for in-kind assistance, where my flash drives and things were manufactured or dysfunctional, became dysfunctional for no reason that I can come up with. But basically, that's what I wanted to do.
Well, we will go ahead and hear the amicus and the government this morning. You may have a seat, sir.
One more statement. I don't believe that the argument that they're making is frivolous. And basically, they can't win or get a reversal here. And it shouldn't go back on a remand because it's prejudice to me. It delays a award of benefits, which I believe I'm entitled to. But thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. We'll hear from the amicus.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Micah Smith of O'Melveny & Myers, appointed as amicus counsel to brief and argue in support of the position of Kevin Jones. We were not appointed as counsel for Kevin Jones, and that's a big part of why there has been some confusion and some misunderstanding as to what the relationship is. Mr. Jones,
we were invited, and we graciously accepted the role of amicus because the court benefits from having counsel on both sides of the case, and we, as you heard during the swearing-in, we greatly appreciate the pro bono efforts of the bar, and we do this morning as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do want to briefly say something about the last few comments that Mr. Jones made. And Mr. Jones made a reference to the merits of the arguments that amicus counsel have argued in their briefs and are prepared to argue today. And we do want to say that although Mr. Jones suggested that the arguments were frivolous, we believe he was referring to our alternative argument about the possibility that if we were not able to persuade the panel on the merits of our first argument, then there would still be a basis for vacater. We don't understand Mr. Jones to disagree with us about our principal argument, because our principal argument would lead to a remand for the calculation of benefits as opposed to the remand that is currently in place. The principal question in this case, and I just alluded to it, is whether sentence 4 of section 405G of the Social Security Act authorizes remands for reopening of the administrative record. And amicus counsel submit that the text, structure, purposes, and legislative history of section 405G all support the conclusion that sentence 4 does not authorize remands for reopening. To begin, the text of sentence 4 does not authorize remands for reopening. Sentence 4 authorizes district courts to enter a judgment affirming, modifying, or reversing a decision of the commissioner with or without a remand for rehearing of the cause before the commissioner. So the precise question before the court is whether the word rehearing in sentence 4 should be construed as authorizing review of the case based on the record already in existence, as amicus counsel contend, or whether it should be instead construed more broadly to authorize remands for reopening of the administrative record and the taking of additional evidence, as the commissioner contends. And we've argued that the narrower interpretation of the word rehearing is the more technically accurate and natural one. And we've submitted briefs that cite materials that support that proposition. The commissioner, however, argues that the word rehearing can also sometimes be used more broadly to refer to a proceeding in which new evidence is taken. And we don't disagree with that argument, but we don't think it is enough to require sentence 4 to be construed in the manner the commissioner suggests. And we say that for two reasons. First, as I just noted, we believe that the definition of the word rehearing that limits it to reconsideration of the record already in existence is the more technically accurate and natural one. And it is the one that we believe Congress is more likely to have had in mind when it adopted Section 405G in 1938 and amended it in 1980. The second reason is that we...
What circuits, if any, have passed on that interpretation question that you're talking about?
This court has not, and the Supreme Court has not either, as the commissioner recognizes. The First Circuit has considered the question, the Second Circuit has considered the question, and the Sixth Circuit has considered the question.
Out?
None of those circuits had before them a robust argument about the text, structure, purposes, and legislative history of the provision.
How did they come out?
But they all did allow sentence 4 remands for reopening of the administrative record. And we've argued in our briefing that none of those opinions was persuasively reasoned, and we don't believe that this court should follow those decisions, and I'd be happy to explain why. The structure of Section 405G, its purposes and its legislative history, confirm, we believe, that so long as the definition of rehearing that we've proposed is a permissible one, then it is a required one in light of the context of the statute in which the word appears. The First Circuit considered this question, but only in the context of an argument raised by the claimant in that case that it would be appropriate to punish the commissioner just as a claimant is punished when evidence isn't presented before an administrative law judge. And what the First Circuit reasoned was that the commissioner is not represented before the administrative law judge, and the proceedings before the administrative law judge are non-adversarial proceedings, and that it therefore would not be appropriate to punish the commissioner for a failure to present evidence, even if it would be in some sense appropriate to hold it against a claimant who did not present evidence in his or her possession. We do believe that the First Circuit was correct to note that proceedings before the administrative law judge are non-adversarial, but we believe that the First Circuit drew the wrong conclusion from that fact. The reason for construing sentence 4 in the manner that the text, structure, purposes, and legislative history suggest is not to punish the commissioner, but in order to effectuate a clear congressional purpose that Congress enacted into the statute. And that purpose was highlighted in amendments that Congress made to the Social Security Act in 1980. Before 1980, under sentence 6 of section 405G, which is a second way in which a district court can remand a case, the commissioner had the ability to ask for a sentence 6 relief for the taking of additional evidence prior to filing his answer and the certified administrative record in the district court. And what Congress noted in the legislative history to the 1980 amendments was that the commissioner had grown too reliant on his ability to obtain remands. And this was significant for a very specific reason. The appeals council within the Social Security Administration was not, as a consequence of the ability to obtain remands, doing an adequate job of reviewing the decisions of administrative law judges.
Pause you for a second. When Congress amended Section 6, it didn't amend Sentence 6, it didn't amend Sentence 4, did it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So how can we take anything from the reason that they amended Section 6, Sentence 6 in terms of interpreting Sentence 4?
There are two responses to that question, Your Honor. The first is that although Congress in 1980 tightened the restrictions on Sentence 6 relief, there were already restrictions in place even before 1980.
No, I understand that. What I'm asking is, how can we take anything at all from what happened in 1980?
You
have to go back to whatever happened originally, but how does 1980 help or hurt you?
That's correct, Your Honor. We believe that the structure of the statute as it existed in 1938 already suggests a congressional purpose.
But there's nothing about 1980 that helps you one way or the other. I'm reading from the Supreme Court's opinion in Melkonian where they said, the amendment to Sentence 6, of course, was not intended to limit a district court's ability to order remands under Sentence 4.
That's correct.
So,
and that is an accurate
statement. Why are the 1980 amendments relevant at all to this case?
And they're relevant for this specific reason. When Congress decided that it was important to amend the Social Security Act to tighten the restrictions on Sentence 6, it did that because it believed that evidentiary remands were causing unwarranted delay in the resolution of Social Security disability claims. And the solution was to limit the ability of both the commissioner and claimants to obtain evidentiary remands. And Congress expressly noted that it did not intend the good cause, the timeliness, the newness and materiality limitations to be engrafted onto Sentence 4, and that Sentence 4 remands would continue to operate as they had before. But we believe that that is a very clear sign that Congress did not believe it was necessary in order to effectuate its purpose of limiting evidentiary remands under Sentence 6 to apply those same restrictions to Sentence 4. And we believe that supports the conclusion that Congress did not understand and should not have understood Sentence 4 to authorize those same evidentiary remands.
I understand why you make this argument in order to counter a sort of claim of horribles by the other side of what the consequence of your interpretation would be. But why is Congress's 1980 explanation of what happened in the 1930s particularly relevant to us? To the extent legislative history is important, it's legislative history of the Congress that passes the statute, not legislative history of a Congress 50 years later.
As an ordinary matter, post-enactment legislative history is not persuasive as an explanation of what the statute intends to accomplish. But this Court has recognized that when Congress amends a previously existing statute and offers legislative history, then that legislative history can perhaps be relevant. And we believe that it's relevant here. And we believe it's relevant because the structure of Section 405G already suggested in 1938 that Congress did not intend for Sentence 4 to operate as an end run around Sentence 6. And we believe that what the legislative history to the 1980 amendments allows this Court to see is that Congress continued to believe that and believed it even more strongly in 1980. And we don't take the position that the 1980 amendments are necessary in order to see within the structure of the statute that Congress thought Sentence 4 should not be an end run around Sentence 6. We believe that the text of Sentence 4 and the structure of Section 405G are sufficient to support that conclusion. We do believe that the legislative history adds another piece to that argument and further supports the argument, but we don't believe it's essential to the argument.
About the Supreme Court's opinion, I guess in the two Sullivan cases, but particularly in the Finkelstein case, the court says that there are two quite different purposes for Sentence 4 and Sentence 6. And then in trying to figure out what the district court did in the Finkelstein case, the court says Respondent points out that the district court stated that it was ordering a remand because the evidence on the record was insufficient to support the secretary's conclusion, and that further fact-finding regarding respondent's ailment was necessary. We do not agree with respondent that the district court's action in this case was a six-sentence remand. The sixth sentence plainly describes an entirely different kind of remand, appropriate where the district court learns of evidence not in existence, etc. This seems to indicate that the court thinks, I should say more than seems to, it does indicate that the court thinks that when the district court ordered more evidence under it was doing it under sentence four, not under sentence six.
And with respect, Your Honor, we disagree. We think
disagree
that
with the Supreme Court or disagree with me?
We disagree.
You're allowed to disagree with me.
We would disagree with an interpretation of Finkelstein that would undermine our argument. And the reason we disagree is that we believe that what Finkelstein was referring to was, in fact, a sentence four remand. Keeping in mind that Finkelstein wasn't, in fact, about the question presented, in Finkelstein wasn't precisely the difference between sentence four and sentence six. But we believe that what the court was saying in Finkelstein was that when a sentence four judgment is entered, because the existing record does not support the commissioner's conclusion and a merits decision is made, even if the rehearing is to allow the ALJ to make further fact-finding based on the existing record, that is an appropriate sentence for remand.
It's not based on the why do you think it's based on the existing record? Because it says the evidence on the record was insufficient.
We believe that can be interpreted as suggesting that the evidence in the existing administrative record was not adequate to support the findings that the ALJ had made.
And that says that further fact-finding was necessary. You're pushing us pretty hard to say that further fact-finding does not mean to find further facts.
Perhaps it was a reference to further fact-finding, but we believe that the more important part of why that was a sentence for remand, and in fact we think the only reason it was a sentence for remand, was because of the reference to a merits decision. And we think the earlier decision in Sullivan v. Hudson also supports that conclusion. And when the Supreme Court decided in Sullivan v. Hudson just a year before that a remand in that case was the Sullivan v. Hudson decision had remanded the case back down, and it was a later decision in Shalala v. Schaefer that characterized that as only a remand that could only have been entered pursuant to sentence four.
Yes.
And we believe that the reason the Supreme Court said that was because there had been a merits determination. And in the Sullivan v. Hudson description of the remand, the key facts coming from the district court's remand were that a decision was made as to the merits of the case, which is only appropriate pursuant to sentence four, because sentence six does not allow a merits decision. And a remand was made. Sullivan v. Hudson then goes on to describe what the appeals counsel did in that case. And the appeals counsel instructed the administrative law judge to take additional evidence. But we think both in Sullivan v. Hudson and in Sullivan v. Finkelstein, the dispositive fact was that a merits determination had been made. And we believe that that is the distinction between sentence four and sentence six that the Supreme Court had been describing in those cases. And we don't believe that anything in those decisions needs to be read as authorizing reopening of the administrative record.
Isn't that enough? That is, that the court's clearly saying that these sentences are completely different. And it uses words like completely different. One is about remands that follow merits decisions, and one is about remands that precede a merits decision. And so the restraints on the second, on sentence six, don't necessarily apply to the first, sentence four.
They don't apply to the first, but we believe that if sentence four were construed as authorizing the same relief that the commissioner could obtain under sentence six, then the commissioner would never have to satisfy the requirements of sentence six. And that's significant because
they have to risk having a decision against them first. It seems like it's a different thing.
We don't believe that's entirely correct, Your Honor, because this case is perhaps a good example of what we're describing. The commissioner in this case decided that additional evidence was necessary to support a conclusion. Now,
you're assuming he's going to reach the same conclusion.
We're not.
The commissioner concluded additional evidence was necessary. Period. Dot. Full stop.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the reason the commissioner thinks that additional evidence is necessary is because the commissioner wants to preserve the option of reaching the same conclusion. We don't necessarily need to assume that the commissioner will reach the same conclusion.
What I'm questioning, are you reading the commissioner's mind? As far as we know, the commissioner is open to either or any result upon additional evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor, and our argument does not rely on in any way on reading the mind of the commissioner.
Right.
Our argument solely rests on what the commissioner asks for of the district court and what the district court granted the commissioner. And the district court granted the commissioner a reopening of the administrative record, which allows the commissioner to introduce evidence that could potentially lead to the denial of benefits. And what we would suggest is that sentence 4 is not the avenue for obtaining evidentiary remands, and that if the commissioner had wanted to obtain an evidentiary remand, the commissioner should have attempted to satisfy the requirements
of sentence 6. I really hate, since we've talked you past your time already, to open a different subject, but I'm going to anyway. Is there any jurisdictional problem here with regard to the timeliness of the filing of this appeal?
We don't believe so, Your Honor. We briefed the question. And we note that the government hasn't argued that there's no jurisdiction, and we think that the government hasn't because the answer is—
I understand that we have to satisfy ourselves on jurisdiction if the government doesn't.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I mentioned the government's concession because we think the concession is significant in the sense that it shows that the jurisdictional question in this case is a fairly straightforward one. And I'd be happy to describe precisely why.
The Rule 4A, notice of appeal has to be filed within 30 days after the judgment as a general rule.
As a general rule, yes, Your Honor.
What's the exception that means it didn't have to be here?
The exception is under Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4A4A, mm-hmm. Which provides that certain documents filed within a timely manner may toll.
Now, it doesn't say certain documents. It says what?
It specifically says in 4A4A4 that a Rule 59E filing, if timely, tolls the time for filing a notice of appeal.
Now, you're construing the document. Your argument depends on construing the document Mr. Jones filed as a 59E, whatever it is, motion, right?
It doesn't, because 4A4A6 also allows for a timely, and timely in the sense of filed within 10 days back when this case was being litigated, 60B motion as well. And so there are two ways of...
We would have to construe that document as one or the other.
And regardless of how it's construed, it would fall into either the 4A4A4 box or the 4A4A6 box.
If it's a motion, did the judge ever decide it?
The docket is actually a bit unclear, but the district court does seem clearly to have thought that upon the entry of its minute order on May 5th, that it had decided all pending motions. There isn't a mention of...
It doesn't say that, does it?
It doesn't, and there isn't a mention of the March 4th document that Jones filed after the February 25th order. But that March 4th document was filed on March 4th, and it was accepted by the court on March 5th. And it was clearly timely as to the February 25th
filed,
order.
Does it meet the subsection of 59 or 60 that should be made in order to extend the time for filing notice? I don't know.
And we believe that it does. It was a document that Jones filed in light of an unfavorable ruling. He filed it within 10 days, and the district court accepted it.
I suppose if the court didn't, then the appeal's premature, but the prematurity could be cured by a limited remand directing the court to enter a judgment. And once they do that, it's automatically cured under Federal Rule 4A4B1, I think.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, thank you, counsel. We've talked you way beyond your time. Will you be back a couple of minutes for rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Lawrence?
May it please the court, I'm appearing here because of the illness of Mr. Roback.
Sorry for Mr. Roback's illness, but it's always a pleasure to have you before the court.
Thank you, Chief Judge. Sintel, I wanted to point out that we believe both the statutory language, the consistent decisions of the circuits that have addressed this issue, and traditional principles of administrative law support the conclusion that the district court's reversal and remand to the agency for further proceedings was an appropriate response to the record in this case. The statutory language, if you take a look at sentence 4 and sentence 6, deals with timing at a different level. Sentence 4 deals directly with once the a decision based on the pleadings and the record, the transcript of the record, and gives the authority to the court to reverse the decision of the commissioner with or without a rehearing. And what was done here was a reversal of the decision of the secretary, of the commissioner, and a remand for further proceedings. And we believe that succinctly satisfies sentence four.
Well, can you help me with the wording of sentence six begins, the court may, on motion of the commissioner of Social Security, et cetera, remand the case to the commissioner, and it may at any time order additional evidence, but only upon a showing of new evidence and good cause. So my question is of the word any time. On the one hand, we have in the first clause, it says before the commissioner files, and then in contrast, after the in the beginning of the second clause, it says it may at any time. Well, that would sound like it's saying before, after, or any time, including after a ruling on the merits. And if that's the case, it would have the limit that the amicus suggests, namely that it has to have good cause and new evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor, but it's we don't believe that's in the context. It does give authority, a broad authority to the judge in the context of the case. On the other hand, it comes up in a different context, and I believe it was Finkelstein that seems to address that at least to a certain extent and talks about the necessary showing for a sentence six remand. And
we would have to read in non-textually something to suggest that sentence six is only, is all of sentence six, not only the first clause, but the second refers to things that occur, what, before a merits decision?
Before a merits decision, it's not entirely clear, but I would ultimately point out that the three circuits that have addressed this particular context have all upheld the determination, concluding that a sentence for remand is appropriate without any further kind of
determination.
Well,
as I said to the amicus, he's free to disagree with me and and with the other circuits. The only ones we can't disagree with is the Supreme Court. So the fact that the other circuits got there
Absolutely, Your Honor. But I think the context and the timing, the at any time, obviously gives broader authority than simply the first clause of sentence six, and does not limit the district judge's ability to make that kind of determination at any time. On the
but
other
it says,
hand,
but only upon a show at any time, but only upon a showing. Mm-hmm. It's the but only upon a showing part that is the problem.
Yeah. But the sentence four, in contrast, doesn't have that limitation and authorizes the court shall have the power to enter upon the pleadings and transcript of the record a judgment affirming, modifying, or reversing the decision of the commissioner with or without remanding the cause for rehearing. Now, the real distinction here is in context is not something that's stated here, but in under clause, under sentence four, you have an appealable order at that point, and you can take the appeal. Under sentence six, if it's remanded, the district court essentially retains jurisdiction. And I apologize, I don't have the citation with me, but under this court's precedent, generally speaking, a remand to the agency without more does not create an appealable order.
Mr. Lawrence, you made the observation in your brief at 33 that the second clause of sentence six involves not allowing an evidentiary remand, but ordering, requiring the agency to consider new evidence. And although I thought it was explicit in your argument, I see now that it's not, but it seems to me at least implicit that the second clause is there for the benefit of claimants. Mm-hmm. That the first clause is on the motion of the commissioner before answering, and that the second clause is, although it doesn't say on the motion of the claimant, is an authorization for the court to order additional evidence to be taken, and that's on a showing presumably by the claimant, that there is new evidence that was material and should have been incorporated.
It obviously does give more give specific latitude to the claimant in that context. I am personally unaware of any cases that have assessed that particular aspect of sentence six, but obviously on the face of the language, it is certainly a benefit to the claimant at that point.
So we're really left with comparing sentence four and the first clause of sentence six in terms of whether allowing the commissioner here to get a remand under sentence four impairs the or makes superfluous the requirements of sentence 6A, let's call it.
Your Honor, I wouldn't want to go quite that far specifically because of my lack of knowledge here, but I think on its face that reading is a fair reading. On the other hand, the fact that Congress has seen fit to give additional authority to the commissioner in two different contexts doesn't
the two being four and six.
Yes,
four and 6-1, 6A.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, but the authority in 6A is highly circumscribed by
yes, it
the
is.
Two requirements that are not present in four. And if you're right about sentence four, what need is there for sentence 6A?
Well, the context is obviously, I will say from background that I am aware of, that typically that portion of 6A often comes into play. When the commissioner, based on administrative difficulties, has problems either locating the record has been lost and there's nothing to be able to be presented at that point, and that first clause of sentence six is then used to enable the commissioner to go back at a minimum and either retry the case administratively.
Well, couldn't that be done under sentence four? It sounds like a pretty compelling reason for.
The limitation of sentence four on its face requires upon the pleadings and a transcript of the record, so that it requires the filing of an administrative record by the commissioner.
I see. Is that in your brief, that argument?
I do not believe it is directly, Your Honor, but I mean the context
of. There's no transcript.
There is a transcript. There's at least a brief in the joint.
But you're saying in a case where there's no, where it's
right.
been misplayed or what have you, the commissioner can use section six.
Yes, Your Honor.
Sentence six, saying, "Well, I'm not qualified under A, but under six, he's got to come up before answering."
That's correct.
Now, as you say, in this case, that didn't happen.
That's correct. The record and everything was filed.
Nor is there a missing transcript in this case, yeah?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. There's at least a brief transcript of inquiry between the administrative law judge and the appellant here.
So if four was there to make provision, well, I guess what you're saying is four is there to be used if there is a transcript.
Once you have a record, the commissioner may make a determination.
But if there's no in another case, if there's no transcript and you don't file before answering, then you're stuck, right?
I would hate to bind the government in that context, but it would be, I think it's a very different kind of situation, and you may very well be in a position where, although I think as a practical matter, the agency, the commissioner, will know when he's filing, preparing to file his answer, at which time the record is also filed, whether he has a record or not. So he's in a position to make a sentence four judgment if he's got the record, and a sentence six judgment if he is without
it. I believe it's represented in one of the briefs, and I think accurately, that if in this situation, the case we have before us, or any other in which the commissioner does not qualify under sentence six, that if sentence four is not read as an authorization, it remains open to the commissioner to seek to reopen the matter or seek reconsideration on the ground that the predicate for the award of the claim no longer obtains.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
So this is not an annuity we're talking about here. It's whatever number of months it takes you to seek reconsideration.
That's correct. That's correct. But under the circumstances, we believe both the language of sentence 4 and 6 and the case law that is out there in the judgments that have been made, in including this court's decisions in Sims and Narrell, for example, support the determination that the district court may reverse and remand to the agency for further proceedings.
It's hard to deny that the case law leans in your direction and that the Supreme Court has, at least in a dictum, implied or suggested the same thing, but it's also hard to see how they could possibly be right. So then the question is, what's a lower court to do?
Well, we did note that there is the prospect of Chevron deference to the commissioner.
I wonder if Chevron is really applicable here, Mr. Lawrence.
Your Honor,
that section would seem to me part of the impetus for Chevron, or rationale for Chevron, is that Congress has entrusted the statute to the agency for interpretation.
That's correct.
And it would seem that this statute is always going to be interpreted by the district court in the first instance.
Well,
so does Chevron really apply?
I don't have the citation to them, but there are regulations that have been adopted under this system dealing with remands and providing
what happens after remands
and providing for the submission of additional evidence in that matter.
I guess would be at least an implicit agency interpretation, but it still doesn't seem to me to cure the problem that Congress really hasn't delegated this one to the agency yet.
Well, Chief Judge Sentelle, there's obviously tension there, but we believe on balance the agency's position in the adoption of the regulations in light of this and the balance of the act would support Chevron deference.
Introduction to the sentence says the court shall have the power to.
Yes.
So if we adopted your view, we would allow the agency to limit the power of the court by its own regulation. That seems unusual.
Well,
I don't know of any
Chevron
cases.
Even
for Chevron, it goes pretty far.
Well, I think it's contrary to Adams' fruit. Plainly, I mean, where the court said that one doesn't defer to the agency's interpretation of the statute, statutory provision governing access to the court.
That's correct. I mean, I don't
know. The agency could say, all this is fine, but filings have to be pleaded on February 29th, that would rather constrain access to the court.
I understand that the lay of the land is obviously quite different in this context for Chevron deference, but we believe under the circumstances there is a basis for...
You perhaps waited wisely to save Chevron until toward the end of your time. We have talked you past your time.
I had one more. You do?
But I'll let you go.
No. I thought that was an introduction to saying sit down. But since it's not.
It usually is. Does the government take any position at this time on the jurisdictional problems that I discussed with Mr. Smith?
Well, Your Honor, I would just simply say that the record is confused. It's not entirely clear. We believe under the circumstances and with a liberal interpretation of the pro se's filing that they could be construed as appropriate.
It might take the words that the Washington Post never uses an ultra-liberal interpretation to get there, but perhaps we can.
My question goes to their alternative argument, the amicus. So sentence 4 says the court shall have the power to enter with or without remanding the cause for a rehearing.
Yes.
Right? So it's plain that the court could have reversed without remanding. No question about that.
Yes.
So we then have two orders from the court, one of which says, after examining the complaint, the defendant has moved for the decision to be reversed, in this case remanded. Such an order would not prejudice the plaintiff. Now, obviously, the remand part of it does prejudice the plaintiff. And let me just read the second order, then you can respond to both of them together. The second order, which seems even stronger, says, Plaintiff's motions do not provide any salient reasons for granting them and appear to be based on a misunderstanding of the extent of this court's powers under the law. In reviewing an agency's final decision in a case such as this one under 405G, this court is not empowered to make substitute findings of fact or decisions for the agency. In short, the plaintiff has already obtained the maximum relief, reversal and remand, that the court is authorized to award in a 405G case. Now, since we know that that is not the maximum relief, since he can get reversal without remand, don't we have a situation where the district court simply misunderstood its power? Now, maybe it'll go ahead and do the same thing, but it seems to have misunderstood its power in the case. Why not?
There is obviously some, I believe, some confusion there. But in the context...
What's confusing about it? It seems he says he doesn't have any power. Why is that confusing?
Well, no, in that sense, I don't believe it is confusing, Your Honor. But in the context of this case and the steps that he took, it is obvious that what he looked at in terms of the record and the commissioner's motion requesting a remand to get the vocational expert to address the situation because the record that was before the court... and ultimately before the appeals council, but they declined review, did not have that aspect, and there were non-exertional limitations on the claimant that had not been examined
right,
by a vocational expert.
So you have a situation where the record on which the agency has denied the disability is inadequate, right?
That's correct.
And the burden at this point was on the agency, not because we've gone to that step five, right?
Well, Your Honor, I think in there are the cases that we've that have been cited, especially the circuits that have addressed it, have gone in a little bit more to the burden. It's called more often a burden of going forward,
yes.
And its basis in that context is because it's not a traditional adversarial process.
It didn't go forward.
Well,
whatever you call the burden, whether it's a burden of going forward or a burden of proof, they blew it. And now the question is what should be done, and doesn't the court have the authority to say, yes, okay, maybe the government can meet its burden, we'll send it back? Or the court could say, well, this case has taken an awful long time, and as an equitable matter, the government had its shot, and I'm just not going to let it go any further.
Well, Your Honor, I think, and this may be where the court was talking, the record has to show that the claimant is entitled to benefits, and based on this record, the claimant is not entitled to benefits. There may be a gap in the record, which is what the district court was addressing.
Well, let's say the agency simply rested. The plaintiff got through steps 1 through 4, and the agency never said another word. There would be no question then that he was entitled to benefits, would there?
I would disagree with that, Your Honor, because of the nature of the proceeding, because you have the inquisitor, if you will, holding the hearing, and the only party before the inquisitor at that point is the claimant. You don't have the commission.
Are you saying, because I think we have at least one case by Judge Leventhal in which we did order a reversal without a remand. Are you saying a court is without power to in any case where the plaintiff satisfies steps 1 through 4 and the government does nothing to simply reverse?
I believe the statute requires, Your Honor, and I apologize, I'm not as familiar as perhaps I should be at this point, but...
We understand you got the file very late in the day.
But my understanding of the statutory scheme is the record has to show that the claimant is entitled to benefits, and based on this record, there may be questions, and there's obviously a gap in the record because under the circumstances, as the commissioner indicated in his motion, there was no... employment of a vocational
expert.
Doesn't
the language of the statute itself clearly contemplate the possibility of a reversal without remand?
Yes. Yes.
So
I mean, in that sense, yes.
Well, it might be that on given facts, maybe those of this case even, that a court could only reverse and remand when the judge seems to believe that he has only the power to reverse with remand. That is a misunderstanding of his authority, right?
That would be, and the only other explanation would be that what the court meant was that he was basing it on this record, and he believed he didn't have the authority.
Didn't he seem to say that that was the maximum result possible?
Yes, it did.
Correct, he didn't just say that. That's the most I can do in this case. That's the maximum result possible.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And I suppose, in the interest of full disclosure, I have reversed without remand as a district judge on Social Security disability cases. So you probably couldn't find those. They were all unpublished, but I've full disclosure.
There's no question that he has the authority to reverse. The question is those circumstances and exactly what his cryptic remarks intended.
Well, the first cryptic remark was made without hearing from the plaintiff at all, right? That is the
That's
first
correct.
Order. There wasn't even
yes.
notice.
That was within 3 days of the motion that was made. Unless there are further questions, we would ask that the judgment
be affirmed. None at this point. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We talked you out of your time before, Mr. Smith, but we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal if you'd like.
I'd like to just make three quick points. The first is that the commissioner has offered no answer or no persuasive answer to the problem that an interpretation of sentence 4 that allowed evidentiary remands would create. And that was the problem that the provisions of sentence 6 and the limitations imposed upon that sentence 6 would be rendered, as a practical matter, superfluous. One of the arguments that the commissioner suggested was that there is a timing distinction. But we don't believe that that is a persuasive reading of the language of sentence 6, which authorizes the district court to remand for reopening of the administrative record at any time. We would also...
Why, just on the superfluous part, why, taking the Supreme Court at its word, sentence 6 refers to situations before there's been a decision on the merits. Sentence 4 is after there's been a decision on the merits. It doesn't make it sentence 6 superfluous. It just says if the commissioner wants to do something without taking the risk or possibly the benefit of getting a merits rule, then it's restricted by, he or she is restricted by sentence 6, and otherwise it's unrestricted. Why does that make it superfluous?
We believe it makes it superfluous because the commissioner is always in a position to say that if evidence the commissioner needs is not currently in the record, that there has been error and that there should be a reversal of the commissioner's decision. And that's exactly what happened in this case, that the commissioner needed evidence that was not in the record, and so the commissioner simply confessed error under sentence 4 and asked for a remand for reopening of the evidence. And the commissioner could do that unilaterally in any case.
Although I suppose he risks having a judge like Judge Sentell, who might, as a district judge, just order reversal, and that's the end of it.
That's correct, Your Honor. But we do think that when Congress imposed limitations on sentence 6, it chose the method by which to restrain the availability of evidentiary remands. And there might be additional equitable reasons for restraining the availability of sentence 4, but we think Congress chose the ways in which sentence 6 should, in evidentiary remands, should be restrained. One case that I'd like to point out is the Goodson case cited. On page 26 of the commissioner's brief. Footnote 8 of that case granted a motion to supplement the record, and the court then remanded for rehearing. And that's an example of sentence 4 and sentence 6 happening at the same time. And it would further suggest that it's not appropriate to say that a remand for supplementation of the record couldn't happen at the same time as a merits determination. We don't think the timing argument is a persuasive one. And we think that that leaves then the question of whether, if this court disagrees with amicus counsel's interpretation.
I think you're now making your same point again rather than rebutting.
No, this, Your Honor, is just the very last point, that if the court
yes.
disagrees with our interpretation, and if it's okay, I'd like to just make this one last point. Which
you're actually out of time, and this is for rebuttal that you rise now, and that so.
Yeah, and
it doesn't
like
sound like you're really rebutting at this point, so the court will call an end to this case. We want to thank you for your appearance as pro bono amicus in the case. We thank also the law firm of O'Melveny & Myers for supporting you in this endeavor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. This case will be submitted, and we'll take a brief recess.